Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. Happy Hump Day. Well, today I thought we'd talk about something that has happened forever. I never really understood why anybody would want to take a person that didn't belong to them and try to keep them when they didn't want to be there. I'm talking, of course, about kidnapping. And through our history, there's been a lot of it. There's been a lot of horrible crimes involving kidnapping. So I thought today we'd talk about that a little bit. On the news front, of course, there's the story of Elizabeth Smart. And this young woman was kept for 9 months, which in the scheme of things, when you know about what happened in Cleveland, when those three women and the one young woman who gave birth to her tormentor's child, 10 years. And there's been other stories. And, of course, often they end in real tragedy. But I thought this morning we'd talk about some of the things. I did find some information about the 10 most, notorious or well-known kidnappings that have happened through the years. And then I'm going to read a little bit about Elizabeth Smart, who kind of won the world over because she survived and put herself in a good place. She wrote a book, and she's got all kinds of good things going on. So, but I think first we'll get started with some of the information that I came up with in regard to kidnappings that happened in our history. I found it very interesting. Most of them I remembered, but a lot of them from other countries I did not. This story is called The 10 Worst Child Kidnappings in History. The revelation that a father kept his own daughter a prisoner for 24 years and fathered her 7 children shocked the world. But that case is not an isolated one. It only brought back the memories of other sick crimes that happened in the past. Austria holds the infamous record in child kidnapping cases, but the police and the public are hoping that no more children will ever be kept prisoner in their country, such as the case with Elizabeth, Natasha, and 3 sisters, Victoria, Katharina, and Elizabeth. Natasha was kept a prisoner for 8 years and escaped her captive in August of 2006. When she was 10 years old, Wolfgang, I'm not going to use their last names, for one thing I can't say them, I'll butcher them, and it doesn't matter anyway, kidnapped her and carefully kept her away from prying eyes by locking her away in a room under his garage. Natasha later said that Wolfgang did not rape her and treated her kindly. He even took her skiing, but she was not allowed to go to school or have any friends. She was his property. She escaped one morning while she was washing his car and he was talking on the telephone. After she ran away, Wolfgang killed himself for fear of being lynched by the public. But Natasha came out of it physically and psychologically healthy. Besides, she earned a great deal of money selling her story to the media, who fought to get the scoop on her captivity story. But 3 sisters who were held captive in total darkness by their own mother were not so lucky. At the age of 7, 11, and 13, Victoria, Elizabeth, and Katharina fell victims to their mother's breakdown after a divorce. Their mother withdrew them from school, claiming they would be home-tutored. She managed to convince the court that her ex-husband was abusive, and the court forbade him to see his children. She kept her daughters in total darkness for 7 years, and the place they lived in was full of garbage and filth. The girls later said they played with mice and communicated with a language they had made up. Unfortunately, all three suffer from grievous psychological consequences of their captivity. Two kidnappings happened in England, and one was inspired by the other. 3-year-old Madeleine McCann disappeared while on vacation with her parents in Portugal on May 3, 2007. She has still not been found and is presumed dead. Inspired by her case and the attention it received, the mother of 9-year-old Sharon Matthews and her lover on November 11th staged the girl's kidnapping and tried to get hold of money from a missing children's association. God. But after a 24-hour search and the 300 police and 60 detectives were involved, the girl was found under her mother's lover's bed. The mother and her lover were jailed, and the child was given to social services. But Great Britain was also shaken by a case of murder. 8-year-old Sarah Payne was kidnapped near a cornfield in West Sussex. She had been kidnapped by a registered pedophile, a car mechanic by the name of Roy Whiting. He killed her after her parents appeared on television pleading to get their daughter back. He got life in prison. Pedophiles are the most frequent abductors. Pedophiles are the most frequent culprits in child kidnapping cases, but it's rare for them to keep a child for a longer period of time. Most often, they turn to other victims. So it is incomprehensible that Roy Whiting had none. A Belgian pedophile, Mark Dutroux, also did something that was atypical of a pedophile. He kidnapped 12-year-old Sabine Dardenne and held her in his home for 80 days, sexually molesting her every day in 1996. Sabine managed to free herself, however, and Mark got 15 years in jail. Okay, now, don't even try to explain that to yourself, because obviously there's no sense in that. We should not forget to mention the greatest tragedy of them all. In September 2004, Chechen rebels kidnapped all the children from a Bessian primary school and killed 331 of them. Europe is not the only part of the world where children are abused, although most kidnappings do occur there. June Candelario kept her grandson in a doghouse for 3 years for 11 hours each day. Luckily, a passing police officer noticed the child and saved it. The grandmother was sentenced to 5 years in prison, another thing that there's no explanation for. The United States are more fruitful ground for ransom-motivated kidnappings. The daughter of media mogul Patty Hearst was kidnapped at the age of 19 in February 1974. Gosh, it doesn't seem like it's been that long ago. She was kidnapped by a terrorist organization whose goal was to free America from fascist vermin. The group demanded $70 million to release Patty. But the bizarre fact was that she later joined the group. I remember all this. For she spent 2 years in prison before she was pardoned by President Jimmy Carter. The oldest kidnapping in which the youngest child ever had been kidnapped happened back in March of 1932. The grandson of the famous American pilot Charles Lindbergh was kidnapped at only 20 months old. After a 10-week search, the baby was found dead. Bruno Hauptmann was accused of the crime, his only motive being jealousy. Now, I had always believed that that child belonged to Charles Lindbergh, not his grandchild. So, if you know different than that, as I said many, many times, I take this stuff off the computer and any other places that I can find that's supposed to be bona fide, proper news. But that doesn't sound right to me. I will research that again today and see if that's true, if it was really his grandson. However, I think what we're finding out here by reading all of this is in a lot of cases, it's more abuse being perpetrated by parents, which is incredibly sad to me. Of course, recently, the three women that we kept for 10 years and a man who obviously realized, even though he said he didn't know what was wrong with him, at least he had the decency, I don't know if I should even say this, but he had the decency to take his own life because he couldn't deal with what he did. So maybe there was something in him that understood what he had done was horrific. But in many cases, obviously, in some of the stories that I just read, the perpetrator was somebody that these children trusted and loved. And in my eyes, that's the worst thing that can happen. The story of Elizabeth Smart is a strange one, and I'm going to open up the lines so Shelley can talk if she'd like to interject while I'm reading this story. So, good morning, Shelley.
Good morning, Rainey.
How are you?
Doing good. Yeah, these are quite distressful facts you're reading this morning. I had heard of some of these. But the ones that I had not heard of shocked me a little. When you get into the depravity of how people treat each other, and especially when you're talking about children, you know, children are elderly. Any part of our society that's vulnerable, it's more despicable because then you're dealing with somebody that can't even fight back. You know, it's when two people that are equally matched go head-to-head and one gets injured, that's one thing. But when you're talking about people that prey on the vulnerable, it's just so despicable. It's hard to find the words to describe it.
Well, you know, something I could never get. I mean, I've watched movies and I've watched documentaries about things that have happened in the past. And the one show that we did about mental institutions and the depravity of people years ago because there was no other explanation and they didn't know how to deal with things. And we know way back in the 1800s and times like that, if you gave birth to a child that had any kind of deformity or any kind of mental deficiencies or anything like that, they often were just put in a room and starved to death and left to die. And people, for some reason, considered that acceptable. And I do think that we as a people follow the lead of each other. You know, I mean, there's many stories and news reels that we can watch all the time about gang mentality and everybody jumping on the same bandwagon. And of course, right now, our country is in a terrible place, and there's things going on that I'm having trouble as a grown woman accepting for necessary. I'm feeling in my heart that there should be somebody who can step up today in the next hour and say, stop this nonsense. This is bullshit. Fix this, and fix it now. You're all sitting in seats of tremendous, tremendous power, and yet you can play with the people that struggle from day to day. I don't get it. And then I read stories like this, and these people, well, you heard the jail terms. I mean, 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years? What's 10 years? Nothing. So, but I'm going to read Elizabeth Smart's story because this is one of complete manipulation and, again, tells us how many people that are walking the streets that should be helped in another way, not until it's too late and they have to be prosecuted and persecuted and all that kind of stuff. They should be helped before something like this happens. Elizabeth mm-hmm. Smart was the kind of fame nobody would want. In the summer of 2002, at the age of 14, She became one of the nation's most famous kidnap victims when she was abducted from her bedroom in Salt Lake City, where she lived with her devout Mormon family. Her kidnapper, Brian David Mitchell, saw himself as a religious prophet. He took her to be his second wife in a polygamous marriage. With a knife at her throat, Mitchell forced her to go with him to his remote camp on a mountain near Salt Lake, where they lived during the first stage of her nine-month captivity. Smart tells us Terry Gross is a reporter, that Mitchell knew exactly how to get what he wanted. He was a master of manipulation, she says. Smart was raped by him nearly every day, sometimes several times a day. The only other person in their camp was Mitchell's wife, Wanda Barzee, who treated Smart like her slave. 8 years after the police found Smart and freed her, Mitchell was sentenced to life in prison. Barzee was sentenced to 15 years after reaching a plea deal. As for Smart, she's now married and finishing work at her on her degree at Brigham Young University. She's the head of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, which helps prevent crimes against children and educate children about how to protect themselves if they are mistreated by a stranger. Her memoir, My Story, has just been published. She writes in her book that... Well, I'll just read what she wrote. My parents have raised me to believe in a kind and loving God and someone who cares about me, who is always there for me, and who would never wish harm or illness or any kind of tragedy upon me. And then here is this man and this woman are telling me that actually God has ordained them to do this and that they have been called to kidnap young girls and that I should be grateful. I should be thankful for what's happening to me. Most of these are some, you know, they've just picked from her book and her memoirs to share in this article. They ask her about the camp where she was held, and she said, "It's not far from my home, but it is not an easy climb. It is extremely difficult to get there." Excuse me. There are so many trees and close-growing bushes, and you are climbing up a very, very steep incline. It's not a walk in the park. I wasn't so much afraid of the mountains, but I was afraid of him. And I felt the further I got away from my home and my family, the less chance I would have of escaping, the less chance I would have of getting away. Although it may seem for those people who have never been there, it may seem like it's not that far away. To me, it felt like an eternity just because it was such a long hike. And this man, he seemed to have planned for everything. When I got to the camp, I didn't come to just a tent thrown up in the middle of the woods. No, it was very well laid out. It was very well stocked, and it was very well prepared. He had cables running from one end of the camp to the other, which he chained me up to. Then they ask her about the woman, and she said she felt jealous of me. I mean, that's what all of their fights were about, and they fought all the time, but at the same time, that's what she wanted. These weren't just his choices, they were her choices too. I mean, she knew that what she was doing was wrong, but she was still okay with it. So yes, she was mistreated, but she didn't have to be. That was her choice. For her to sit by and watch what happened to me and not do anything, not say anything, she had passed the point of feeling sympathy or feeling anything for anyone but herself. They ask her how people avoided them because of their dirty physical appearance. They dressed in dirty robes and veils. That was right after 911 had happened. It was at a time when, even more so than now, that religion was a very hot topic. And there were so many people from different religions that were being mistreated because of how they looked or because of some extremist group did something terrible. It was a hard time. And by looking a certain way, Mitchell found that people were a bit more standoffish, that they didn't want to get too close. It was really just another way of manipulating people around him, getting them to stay away, getting them to want to avoid us. It was not uncommon for us to walk down a street and there'd be people walking towards us, then they'd stop and cross the street and walk around us. And then cross the street and come back to the same side they were on because they didn't want to pass us that close on the street. On the best advice her mother gave her, she commented this: "The morning after I was rescued, my mom gave me the best advice ever been given. My mom said to me, 'Elizabeth, what this man has done to you is terrible. There aren't words strong enough to describe how wicked and evil he is. He has stolen 9 months of your life from you that you will never get back. But the best punishment you could ever give him is to be happy, is to move forward with your life and do exactly what you want to do. The best thing you can do is move forward, because by feeling sorry for yourself and holding on to what's happened, that's only allowing him more power and more control over your life. And he doesn't deserve another second. So be happy.' I'm not perfect at following her advice, but I do try to follow it every day." She has, she's supporting a group called RAD, which I've never heard of until I read this, Resist Aggression Defensively. It's a kids program. It's called RAD Kids, is based on three simple principles. The first principle is that you're special and nobody has the right to hurt you. The second principle is, because you're special, you don't have the right to hurt anyone else, unless you have to defend yourself. So she's a very, very bright young girl. Let me finish that comment. I couldn't find that paper. "Unless someone is hurting you, and then you can do whatever it takes to get away, whatever it takes to be safe, to escape from whatever situation you're in, then by all means, do whatever it takes. Bite, scream, kick, yell, whatever. The third principle, which is most important in my opinion, is that if something happens, it's not your fault, and you can tell. Not only can you tell, but you should tell." So it sounds like in this horrible story, there is a happy ending. I'm sure she deals with internal trauma, because I know on any level, when anybody hurts you, I talk about this a lot, hurting you physically is sometimes easier to get over than hurting you mentally. You know, that old story, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. That's really not true. That's really, really not true, because often our hurt feelings guide us through life and make us make poor decisions, a lot more so than anything physical that's ever happened to us. But I saw a lot of pictures of Elizabeth online. She's beautiful. She has a look of serenity. I hope that's true. I wish her all kinds of love and luck, and hope that she continues to move forward, because her story is one of real, honest-to-goodness survival. So what do you think, Shel?
Well, I was impressed by her mother's advice, because I think that most victims are not given advice like that. I think most victims, you know, people out of their own compassion tend to feel sorry for a victim instead of feeling compassion. And there is a difference, by the way, feeling sorry or feeling compassion. When you feel sorry for someone, you actually lock them in that victim mode. You keep them in that dense emotion. And there's a lot of psychology behind that. And some of the way that people are dealing with it now is very different, and it actually helps the person to rise above what happened to them. when you keep someone reliving the experience and you feel sorry for them, you actually keep them in that emotion that cripples them. So for her mother to say, you know, the best way for you to deal with this is to realize you can't go back and, like one of your phrases, you can't unring the bell. It's happened. You survived it. You're here. So now, you know, the best way to not be, continually be victimized by this man is to go ahead and have the life that you would have had. And like Elizabeth said, you know, it's easier said than done, but the bottom line is it is done. I've read some other survival stories recently and or seen some things on TV, and you see the same thing happen. You see rape victims, or you see victims of violence, or you see victims of catastrophic accidents, and one of them, their life is ruined. They lose their families. They lose their jobs. They just spiral down after this terrible thing that happened to them. And then you see somebody else that suffered almost an identical horror in their life, and they're stronger. They have more of a passion for life because they survived. And they not only do they rise above it, but when you talk to them, they're happy. They don't stay in the energy of that horrific thing that happened to them. And so it is very interesting how our attitude towards what happened to us, and we've discussed this on other shows for other reasons, but the mm-hmm. attitude of what we take will either strengthen us or completely destroy us. And I give her mother a tremendous amount of applause for giving that advice, because I think it's unusual. It's not usually where people go. And her mother must have been a very strong, very connected woman to say something like that. So I was very impressed with it, because I think that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, but I thought it was beautiful too. But most of my interactions with the Mormon faith is that they are very faithful, very devout people as a rule. And I, too, thought her words were full of love and wisdom, and I can't imagine what kind of heaviness is in her heart as her mom. You know, hurting you is, I don't know. If somebody hurts you as a person, you go through all different kinds of emotions, anger, hurt feelings, getting even, I don't care, you can do whatever you want to me, it means nothing to me. You know, we go through denial, we go through everything. When somebody hurts your kid, I'll tell you, it's a whole different story. It's a cut.
The maternal and paternal instincts are overwhelming. And when can you imagine, I mean, I can't, I don't even want to go there, but can you imagine, you know, 9 months, 9 years, whatever, some of these abductions go on for a decade or more, can you imagine not having your child there and not knowing every day what's happening to them, not having a clue, not knowing whether they're still alive, you know, were they killed, are they still alive, are they suffering every day? I mean, when I hear stories like this, my heart goes out to the parents as much as to the child that was abducted, because the not knowing can just push you over the edge, and in some cases it has for some of these parents. It's just an overwhelming emotion of uncertainty of not knowing if your kid is okay. I mean, did somebody take them that's abusing them and torturing, or did somebody take them that just wanted a companion and you know, is keeping them locked up but not hurting them on a daily basis? And, you know, all those, you let your imagination run, and it can just be devastating.
Well, and I think for most parents, when they can't rescue their child, one of their biggest emotions that they have to deal with is the fact that they think that their kid, that they don't want them because they haven't come and rescued them.
Right.
And
right.
I,
right.
I see that, you know, I can feel that feeling as a parent, that they would think that you didn't care. And especially if they're real young, because when they're real young, they think you as mom and dad can do anything. You know, you rule the roost. So if somebody took you away, it's just a matter of time. They're going to find you, and my dad's going to beat the hell out of you. You know, that's how a little kid thinks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of the stories and some of the things that we've read about through the years, I mean, that we've read about recently, but through the years that have happened in our history, the abuse of each other has been horrendous. And this month is National Bully Prevention Month, by the way, the month of October. So pretty much, even though we started out this show talking about bullying more than anything, the more we talked about it, the more we realized that it was connected to absolutely, positively every other thing that goes on in this world.
That's right.
It is separated in any way. Isn't that right, Shell? Everything that we talk about, whether we talk about unkindnesses to each other or whether we talk about people's rights, it all comes down to other people bullying other people.
That's right.
Almost.
That's right.
It's just like
the cliche. It's just different shades of gray, but it's the same basic concept of somebody who is not quite right, not really content with who they are, and because of it, they're seeking artificial ways of making themselves feel greater. So those artificial ways could either be to be unethical in business deals where they know that they're not being honest, but they're trying to make themselves successful without going through the proper steps, or it's by trashing somebody else, because if they make this person look worse somehow, they think in their heads that it makes them look better, and it never does, but somebody who's in that mode, in that bullying mode, they believe if they can get everybody looking at this person and ridiculing and laughing them, then that's somehow giving them positive attention because everybody now is laughing with them. You know, bringing in that whole like gang and the mob mentality type of thing. So it makes them feel powerful. It makes them feel that everybody likes them because now they have a common enemy. You know, they're trashing this individual over here, or a company, or the president. You know, the president of our country or something like that. You know, they find things to rip apart, so that they have an audience and people clamoring after them. It's all the same defect, though. If you have a person that's themselves, they don't want to tear anything down. They don't want to tear other people down. They don't want to be on ethical business dealings. They don't want to trash people that are in positions of, you know, of power. And it doesn't mean they don't criticize them. I have a lot of criticisms of this government, but the bottom line is, I'm not criticizing any particular individual because it's the whole mechanism that's kind of fouled up right now, you know. And I understand that people are just trying to do the best they can sometimes, you know. But it comes to the point where you got to stop and say, okay, this isn't working. I'm working with a dozen other people. We're all running around like, you know, like hamsters on a wheel. Somebody's got to stop and say, hey, guys, this isn't working. Let's sit down and discuss this and figure out how we can do it better. And sometimes all it takes is that one person that stops the little merry-go-round thing there long enough to look at what's going on and to improve things. But, it's all the same basic thing. When people aren't in a good place with themselves, they make really, really bad decisions. And a lot of times their decisions will absolutely affect other people in sometimes very devastating ways.
Well, I think that the story that we just read about, the man that took Elizabeth, obviously, high intellect, very organized, but, you know, there's a screw loose someplace. And often that's true of people who have those other assets. A lot of times there is something loose up there, and they get in a place where they think that they have all the answers and they're surviving at their highest level. They're very dangerous, people like that.
Yep.
Very, very, very dangerous.
Because they convince themselves that whatever they feel they need to do to feel more in control and power is justified. They feel that what they're doing is okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if deep recesses of their subconscious they do or if it's something they rationalize and convince themselves of. But like you said, these people aren't okay emotionally. There's some defect when you've convinced yourself that it's okay to harm another human being, whether it be to kidnap them and restrain them or to do some act of violence against them or to steal from them. Anytime you've convinced yourself it's okay because of your circumstances or how you feel about yourself, that's a mental aberration. That's a mental illness. There's something not quite right, you know. And it's just amazing how many people are disturbed in some way and where their minds don't function properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think some of these things go back to the old, I don't know, teachings of most parents. And we've talked about this on the show as well. But I do think that it's important for everybody to remember that if you have a child, you know, recently we've been letting AJ, who is 7, walk from the end of our block where the bus drops him off to home. He said to me, "I want to walk home." And his mother, all of his cousins and his brother and even one of his uncles said, "Oh, I don't think he should walk home by himself." And I'm like, "Why?" He's trying to grow up and show his, his maturity and everything. And he also gets very pent up on the bus. And a lot of times he gets off the bus and often I just stand out at the end of the driveway and watch him get off the bus and he runs down the road. Sometimes I go out and see that he's come and I come back in so that he feels very grown up doing it. But in truth, it does scare all of us to let him walk that little ways. Why? Because you never know who's going to be driving down this dirt road. You just never, ever know. So
That's right. We talked,
what are you going to do if somebody stops the car? And well, one of the other parents did ask him if he wanted her to give him a ride because they live right down the street, and she was going to drop him off because I wasn't there. And I'm watching, and he said, "No, thank you, I want to walk." And the next day she told me that he refused to get in her car. And we talked about that. And again, you should be talking about that on a daily basis with your kids, especially if you take them into a giant Walmart, if you take them to a big flea market, if you take them to the carnival, if you take them any of these places where there's all kinds of strangers walking around. I'm sorry, but it can be a very, very dangerous world. And your child has to be told at a very early age that you don't talk to strangers, you definitely don't get in anybody's car, and all the stories that they tell on, even when a policeman comes to school and talks to the kids about avoiding potential harm by not talking to strangers and not helping anybody find their puppy or not do, you know, all of these things, you should be talking to your kids about them all the time. Not scaring them, not making them paranoid, just keeping them aware of the fact that they have to be aware of their surroundings. You know,
South Florida, Central Florida, I guess it'd be considered, is considered the kidnap, or it was 10 years ago, I don't know if it's still the case, but 10 years ago it was considered the kidnap capital of the world, because of all the parks up in Orlando, you know, Disneyland and Universal and stuff, because it's so easy to kidnap a child there. It's it's so congested. There's just hundreds of people anywhere you look around. It gets, so if a kid gets separated from you, they can be swept out of the, and nobody even has time, no reaction time, no time to do anything about it. And that's where a lot of abductions were taking place. I remember I had gone there. At the time, I was engaged to Craig, and Craig and I took my nieces and nephews there for 2 days. And he was supposed to be holding my little niece's hand while I took the two older kids over to see something. I turn around, and he had let go of her hand. You know, he's just not sensitive to that. And I was like, where is she? And he goes, well, she was standing right here. I said, Craig, you got to hold onto her hand. Well, I went nuts. I thought I was going to throw up. I got so panic-stricken, I thought I was going to throw up. It turns out she just saw a display or something, and she was over standing against the glass staring at this thing. It took us like 7 minutes to find her. And I have to tell you, it was probably the scariest 7 minutes of my entire life. I remember that fear to this day. I was absolutely panic-stricken. And at one point, I actually felt physically ill, like I was just not going to make it. And when I saw her, it was just like this sensation. So when I hear about these abduction stories, I know that sensation. I mean, I lived it, you know, even though it turned out okay, I did live it for those few minutes, and it was absolutely intense. And it's, you know, but people don't understand. He let go of her hand literally for like 10 seconds, and she was, bam, she was a good 40 feet away from us. Now, if somebody wanted to abduct her, she would have been gone that day because she was too far out of his line of sight within those few seconds. He didn't even know which direction she had gone. He didn't even realize she had walked away from him because he was checking something on his phone. And it was just, like, ridiculous.
Wow. I know. I remember years ago, my Michael, who just turned 44 this week, I was running the Mountain View in upstate New York, and it was band night, and I was very busy, and my sister calls me. She was watching Mikey. He went to stay with her kids for the weekend, and she called me, and she says, Renee, I can't find Mike. And I was like, what do you mean you can't find Mike? And the band's starting to play, and I'm like, I don't know, 15 miles away from her. I said, I'll be right there. And I will never forget the feelings that I had looking around in the dark, because Ithaca is made up water, lakes, waterfalls, gorges. I mean, it's a beautiful place, but it's also incredibly dangerous. And the hills,
wow,
and troughs and stuff like that. And I'm walking around with a flashlight, afraid to look, you know, literally afraid to look. And we all came walking back to the apartment, and here comes Mikey. He's about, I want to say he was like eight or nine years old. And he said, me and Tim were playing catch, and I crawled under the bushes to look for the ball, and I fell asleep. And I was, what? He says, sorry, Mom, were you worried? I said, yeah. Of course, sorry, with four kids and so many other kids that I've looked after all my life, you know, I have lots of stories like that, but I've never forgotten that one because it was all, you know, he just looked at me like, what's the big deal? You know, and he was the kind of kid who played so hard, if you made him sit still for any length of time, he would fall asleep. And
wow.
We kidded my sister, you know, because she very rarely babysat. And I said, no, you're not babysitting. You let my kids disappear. And it is. It's a scary as hell feeling. You know, I want to read this real quick because this is the only story I found that gave a little background, a little bit more background about somebody who's done something like this, a kidnapping. In 1991, a young woman was abducted in California. And she was something like 11 years old. And she was walking home from school, and this guy grabbed her. And he kept her for 18 years.
Oh.
And at one point in 1991, he took her. In 2009, he went to University of Berkeley, and he was accompanied by two younger girls. And there was something about his behavior, their behavior, that ended up getting him to a parole office. It doesn't explain any of this. It just says this. But when he comes to the parole office with the two young girls, he's accompanied by another young woman who was eventually identified as J.C. Lee Dugard, who was taken 18 years before. And they both, the mother or the wife and him, he was 58 and his wife was 54, and they were arrested for the kidnapping, and he got 431 years in prison, and his wife got 36 years to life. But they talk about him. Now, this is something else that I don't understand why we don't pay attention to. He's born in California. He grew up in the California area where he graduated from high school in 1969. His dad says he was a good boy as a child, but radically changed after a serious motorcycle accident as a teenager. He later turned to drug use, primarily crystal meth. In 1972, he was arrested and charged with sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl, but the case didn't go to trial because the girl declined to testify. In 73, he married Christine Murphy. And let me make sure that that's... I don't know if that's who he was still married to, because it doesn't really give her name up in the beginning of the story. Yeah. No, it's not the same one. But she says that when they were seeing each other, he was abusive, and when she tried to leave him, he kidnapped her. And then that was 73. In 76, he kidnapped Catherine Calloway in California. He took her to Reno, Nevada warehouse, where he raped her for 5.5 hours. When a police officer noticed the car parked outside the unit and then the broken lock on the warehouse, he knocked on the door and was greeted by Garrido. And the woman came out and asked for help. And he was arrested again. He was charged and convicted of crimes in both federal and state courts. They gave him a psychiatric evaluation and was diagnosed as a deviant and chronic drug abuser. The psychiatrist recommended that the neurological examination be conducted because Garrido's chronic drug use could be responsible in part for his mixed or multiple sexual deviation. Garrido was then evaluated by a neurologist. The diagnostic impression was normal neurological examination. In court, he testified that he masturbated in his car by the side of the grammar in high schools while watching girls. He was convicted in 1977 and began serving a 50-year federal sentence on June 30th in 1977 in Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas. In Leavenworth, he met Nancy Boganegra, who was visiting another prisoner, her uncle. In 81, they were married in Leavenworth. In 88, he was released from Leavenworth to Nevada State Prison, where he served 7 months of a 5-years-to-life Nevada sentence. He was transferred to federal parole authorities in I don't know where this is. I guess it's in California again. And he lived with his elderly mother, who suffered from dementia. As a parolee, he was monitored, later wore a GPS ankle bracelet, and visited many times by parole officers. In September of 1990, so he didn't. How many years does that mean he spent? Because when I was reading, I wasn't court ordered 76, 77. So he served like 11 years. 1988, yeah. He's out on parole. And,
wow.
Yeah, so 11 years for all he did. And, wow. In September of 1990, the JC, the young woman, moved from Orange County to near Lake Tahoe, because they thought it was a safe community.
Well,
and that's where he kidnapped her. And the stepfather witnessed the abduction of his stepdaughter and reported the car and everything. You know, so much of this, this really turns into a really big story, so I'm not going to read all of it. But in essence, they have a man who's a repeat offender, who has a history of having these kind of problems. And yet, he's out dealing with, you know, society, and he's, according to what I understand, when they are a predator like this, they have to always, everybody has to know where they live, right, all the time.
Well, that's a new law. I mean, back when you're talking in the 1990s, that I don't believe that was the case. I think that's something that happened later than that. I'm not sure, but I...
That's only 1992. What did I say? When did I say she got... too bad I don't retain information. I'm getting old. Yeah, 91, and in 92, I don't know, Shell. That's 21 years ago. You don't think that they had to tell people where they were if they were a convicted sex offender? We'll have to find that out.
Yeah, I was still in New York when that happened. I left New York in 1998, and for some reason I'm thinking that it happened somewhere, yeah, so maybe the law was already there. But I think it was new and unenforceable. I don't think they had a really good network yet and over the ensuing decade. It became much more prevalent, and then you started having community watch groups that were looking for pedophiles moving into their area or anybody who had ever been convicted of sexual crime. But I think it took a while for it to become enforced, let's put it that way. I think I don't know that it was much earlier than the 1990s then, if in fact it was already enforced then. I don't think it had been enforced for a long time or being monitored. That's just my recollection. That's another thing that maybe we should look into. But I just don't recall it being actively enforced earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, but I mean, you're making an excellent point. Look at what he did. He gets out and he does the same thing again. I know the attitude towards those types of crimes has changed. I know there's a lot of psychologists now that believe that without some sort of pharmaceutical intervention changing their inclinations, that time served does not squelch these types of mental aberrations. You can't put somebody in jail and even put them through therapy in jail and get rid of these very violent and I'm trying to think of the other word for them, depraved desires, inclinations. You know, what they sit around and they just dwell on it. They think about it, they're obsessed with these actions that they want to do. They'll sit in there and they'll behave themselves, and then they're planning for when they get out how to execute things perfectly. Like didn't she say was that Elizabeth Smart when she got there that everything was set up? Was that Elizabeth Smart or was that this woman?
That was Elizabeth Smart.
That was, okay, a different story. I'm getting the stories mixed up. But he had been planning for this. There's no way he wasn't planning for it. He couldn't wait to get out so that he could do this again because he did it too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found a site in regard to this, but it doesn't give me years. It doesn't tell me when they are enacted. I'd have to get deeper into the story, I guess, to find out exactly.
Well, you can probably just Google, you know, when was law passed requiring sex offenders to register. And if you just put that in there, you'll get a bunch of sites come up. You can just Google it as a question.
That I just Googled laws, and the Megan Law, I don't know whether that, but sex registration was what I came up with, and it, but it doesn't, let me see if this one does, but I'm just interested to know, because it seems like so many more things have happened, and this is a great law, and it makes a lot of sense to me, but they're only good if they're used. And,
right.
Well, this one tells me on March 2011, there were 12,596 registered offenders across Australia. So, and
you know, one of the things that's sad, and I know we're running out of time here, so I'll just say this quickly. One of the things that's very, very sad, and anybody listening needs to be aware of this, I've heard of other cases where somebody has had some sort of a head injury, and after the head injury, their personality changes. Depending on what area of the brain was damaged, it can actually change someone drastically. It can make them afraid. It can make them paranoid. It can make them meek, where they feel like they can't function anymore. It could also create violence. It can create sexual aberrations, depending on the area of the brain that was damaged, because sometimes what happens is you get like a short circuit. You might get areas of the brain that are now, like maybe an area of the brain was damaged, so you're not getting the proper connections anymore, so they don't rationalize things, you know. And depending on what area is damaged, I forgot what area of the brain, I think it's in the frontal lobe area, what has to do with impulse control. You know, we all think of stupid things, but, you know, you think of it and you realize it's stupid or it's dangerous or it's not nice, and you don't act on it. Somebody who has that area of their brain damaged with impulse control thinks of something and acts on it because they don't have that, they don't have that circuit breaker anymore. They don't have that thing that says, well, that's a stupid thing to think, or that's dangerous, or that's not nice, or that's, you know, or that's violent, I shouldn't do that. Any random thought that pops into their head, they act on, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, that this is, if all this stuff has been recorded when this kid was really young, here's what I, California was the first state to enact in the United States a sex offender registration in 1947. But community notification of release of sex offenders from incarceration did not occur until almost 50 years later, in 1994, a federal statute called the Jacob Wetterling Act required all states to pass legislation requiring sex offenders to register with state sex offender registries. And then they did it again in 1996 with Megan's Laws. So through the years, it's taken a long time. And every state has done it differently. Okay, yeah. We're down to a minute left. Again, you know, be careful out there, and make sure that your kids understand not to talk to strangers, and not certainly to get in anybody's car. And the perfect idea is to always have your kids, if they're at a playground or something, is to have a buddy. I believe in the buddy system. I believe in that, even with grown-ups. It's important to try not to let your kid be all by themselves. And if they are, like letting AJ walk down the street to establish a little bit of his own trust and the fact that he thinks he's a big kid now, I think that's good too. But you have to make sure that he knows all the ground rules. So everybody have an awesome day today. Remember, it's hump day, so we're on the downhill side. Everybody has a great one, and bless you, and we will be back tomorrow morning. Thanks a lot. Bye, Shel.
All right.
Bye, Rainey. Bye, everyone. Have a great day.